Janus found Han Pritchard in his private quarters. The general was quite apparently preparing for bed. He looked up. News? Not particularly. We'll be at Tazenda in another hop. I know. I don't want to bother you if you're turning in, but have you looked through the film we picked up in Sill? Han Pritchard cast a disparaging look at the article in question, where it lay in its black case upon his low bookshelf. Yes. And what do you think? I think that if there was ever any science to history, it has been quite lost in this region of the galaxy. Janus grinned broadly. I know what you mean. Rather barren, isn't it? Not if you enjoy personal chronicles of rulers. Probably unreliable, I should say, in both directions. Where history concerns mainly personalities, the drawings become either black or white, according to the interests of the writer. I find it all remarkably useless. But there is talk about Tazenda. That's the point I tried to make when I gave you the film. It's the only one I could find that even mentioned them. All right. They have good rulers and bad. They've conquered a few planets, won some battles, lost a few. There is nothing distinctive about them. I don't think much of your theory, Janus. But you've missed a few points. Didn't you notice that they never formed coalitions? They always remained completely outside the politics of this corner of the star swarm. As you say, they conquered a few planets, but then they stopped. And that without any startling defeat of consequence. It's just as if they spread out enough to protect themselves, but not enough to attract attention. Very well, came the unemotional response. I have no objection to landing. At the worst, a little lost time. Oh, no. At the worst, complete defeat. If it is the second foundation. Remember, it would be a world of space knows how many mules. What do you plan to do? Land on some minor subject planet. Find out as much as we can about Tazenda first. Then improvise from that. All right, no objection. If you don't mind now, I would like the lights out. Janus left with a wave of his hand. And in the darkness of a tiny room in an island of driving metal, lost in the vastness of space, General Han Pritchard remained awake, following the thoughts that led him through such fantastic reaches. If everything he had so painfully decided were true, and how all the facts were beginning to fit, then Tazenda was the second foundation. There was no way out. But how? How? Could it be Tazenda? An ordinary world? One without distinction? A slum lost amid the wreckage of an empire? A splinter among the fragments? He remembered, as from a distance, the mule's shriveled face and his thin voice as he used to speak of the old Foundation psychologist, Ebling Miz, the one man who had, maybe, learned the secret of the second Foundation. Pritchard recalled the tension of the mule's words. It was as if astonishment had overwhelmed Miz. It was as though something about the second Foundation had surpassed all his expectations, had driven in a direction completely different from what he might have assumed. If I could only have read his thoughts rather than his emotions. Yet the emotions were plain, and above everything else was this vast surprise. Surprise was the keynote, something supremely astonishing. And now came this boy, this grinning youngster, glibly joyful about Tazenda and its undistinguished subnormality. And he had to be right. He had to. Otherwise nothing made sense. Pritchard's last conscious thought had a touch of grimness. That hypertracer along the etheric tube was still there. He had checked it 1 hour back, with Janus well out of the way. Second interlude. It was a casual meeting in the anteroom of the council chamber, just a few minutes before passing into the chamber to take up the business of the day, and a few thoughts flashed back and forth quickly. So the mule is on his way. That's what I hear, too. Risky. Mighty risky. Not if affairs adhere to the functions set up. The mule is not an ordinary man, and it is difficult to manipulate his chosen instruments without detection by him. The controlled minds are difficult to touch. They say he's caught on to a few cases. Yes, I don't see how that can be avoided. Uncontrolled minds are easier, but so few are in positions of authority under him. They entered the chamber. Others of the Second Foundation followed them. Chapter 3. Two Men and a Peasant. Rossim is one of those marginal worlds, usually neglected in galactic history, and scarcely ever obtruding itself upon the notice of men of the myriad happier planets. In the latter days of the Galactic Empire, a few political prisoners had inhabited its wastes, while an observatory and a small naval garrison served to keep it from complete desertion. Later, in the evil days of strife, even before the time of Harry Seldon, the weaker sort of men, tired of the periodic decades of insecurity and danger, weary of sacked planets and a ghostly succession of ephemeral emperors making their way to the purple for a few wicked, fruitless years, these men fled the populated centers and sought shelter in the barren nooks of the galaxy. Along the chilly wastes of Rossim, villages huddled. Its sun was a small, ruddy niggard that clutched its dribble of heat to itself while snow beat thinly down for 9 months of the year. The tough native grain lay dormant in the soil those snow-filled months, then grew and ripened in almost panic speed, when the sun's reluctant radiation brought the temperature to nearly 50. Small goat-like animals cropped the grasslands, kicking the thin snow aside with tiny, tri-hooved feet. The men of Rossim had, thus, their bread and their milk, and when they could spare an animal, even their meat. The darkly ominous forests that gnarled their way over half of the equatorial region of the planet supplied a tough, fine-grained wood for housing. This wood, together with certain furs and minerals, was even worth exporting, and the ships of the Empire came at times and brought in exchange farm machinery, atomic heaters, even televisor sets. The last was not really incongruous, for the long winter imposed a lonely hibernation upon the peasant. Imperial history flowed past the peasants of Rossim. The trading ships might bring news in impatient spurts. Occasionally, new fugitives would arrive. At one time, a relatively large group arrived in a body and remained, and these usually had the news of the galaxy. It was then that the Rossimites learned of sweeping battles and decimated populations, or of tyrannical emperors and rebellious viceroys, and they would sigh and shake their heads and draw their fur collars closer about their bearded faces as they sat about the village square in the weak sun and philosophized on the evil of men. Then, after a while, no trading ships arrived at all, and life grew harder. Supplies of foreign soft food, of tobacco, of machinery stopped. Vague word from scraps gathered on the televisor brought increasingly disturbing news. And finally it spread that Trantor had been sacked, the great capital world of all the galaxy, the splendid, storied, unapproachable, and incomparable home of the emperors, had been despoiled and ruined and brought to utter destruction. It was something inconceivable, and to many of the peasants of Rossim, scratching away at their fields, it might well seem that the end of the galaxy was at hand. And then one day, not unlike other days, a ship arrived again. The old men of each village nodded wisely and lifted their old eyelids to whisper that thus it had been in their father's time. But it wasn't, quite. This ship was not an imperial ship. The glowing spaceship and sun of the Empire was missing from its prow. It was a stubby affair made of scraps of older ships, and the men within called themselves Soldiers of Tezenda. The peasants were confused. They had not heard of Tezenda, but they greeted the soldiers nevertheless in the traditional fashion of hospitality. The newcomers inquired closely as to the nature of the planet, the number of its inhabitants, the number of its cities, a word mistaken by the peasants to mean villages, to the confusion of all concerned, its type of economy, and so on. Other ships came, and proclamations were issued all over the world that Tezenda was now the ruling world, that tax-collecting stations would be established girdling the equator, the inhabited region, that percentages of grain and furs, according to certain numerical formulae, would be collected annually. The Rossimites had blinked solemnly, uncertain of the word taxes. When collection time came, many had paid, or had stood by in confusion, while the uniformed other worldlings loaded the harvested corn and the pelts onto the broad ground cars. Here and there indignant peasants banded together and brought out ancient hunting weapons, but of this nothing ever came. Grumblingly they had disbanded when the men of Tezenda came, and with dismay watched their hard struggle for existence become harder. But a new equilibrium was reached. The Tezendian governor lived dourly in the village of Gentry, from which all Rossimites were barred. He and the officials under him were dim otherworld beings that rarely impinged on the Rossimite ken. The tax farmers, Rossimites in the employ of Tezenda, came periodically, but they were creatures of custom now, and the peasant had learned how to hide his grain and drive his cattle into the forest and refrain from having his hut appear too ostentatiously prosperous. Then, with a dull, uncomprehending expression, he would greet all sharp questioning as to his assets by merely pointing at what they could see. Even that grew less, and taxes decreased, almost as if Tazenda wearied of extorting pennies from such a world. Trading sprang up, and perhaps Tazenda found that more profitable. The men of Rossem no longer received in exchange the polished creations of the empire, but even Tazendian machines and Tazendian food was better than the native stuff, and there were clothes for the women of other than gray homespun, which was a very important thing. So once again, galactic history glided past peacefully enough, and the peasants scrabbled life out of the hard soil. Nairobi blew into his beard as he stepped out of his cottage. The first snows were sifting across the hard ground, and the sky was a dull, overcast pink. He squinted carefully upward and decided that no real storm was in sight. He could travel to Gentry without too much trouble and get rid of his surplus grain in return for enough canned foods to last the winter. He roared back through the door, which he opened a crack for the purpose.
"Has the car been fed its fuel, Yunker?"
A voice shouted from within, and then Narovi's oldest son, his short red beard not yet completely outgrown its boyish sparseness, joined him. "The car," he said sullenly, "is fueled and rides well, but for the bad condition of the axles. For that I am of no blame. I have told you it needs expert repairs." The old man stepped back and surveyed his son through lowering eyebrows, then thrust his hairy chin outward.
"And is the fault mine? Where and in what manner may I achieve expert repairs? Has the harvest then been anything but scanty for 5 years? Have my herds escaped the pest? Have the pelts climbed of themselves? Nairobi!"
The well-known voice from within stopped him in mid-word. He grumbled,
"Well, well. And now your mother must insert herself into the affairs of a father and his son. Bring out the car, and see to it that the storage trailers are securely attached."
He pounded his gloved hands together and looked upward again. The dimly ruddy clouds were gathering, and the gray sky that showed in the rifts bore no warmth. The sun was hidden. He was at the point of looking away when his drooping eyes caught, and his finger almost automatically rose on high while his mouth fell open in a shout, in complete disregard of the cold air.
"Wife!" he called vigorously. "Old woman, come here!"
An indignant head appeared at the window. The woman's eyes followed his finger, gaped. With a cry, she dashed down the wooden stairs, snatching up an old wrap and a square of linen as she went. She emerged with the linen wrapped insecurely over her head and ears, and the wrap dangling from her shoulders. She snuffled.
"It is a ship from outer space."
And Nairobi remarked impatiently,
"And what else could it be? We have visitors, old woman. Visitors!"
The ship was sinking slowly to a landing on the bare frozen field in the northern portions of Narovi's farm.
"But what shall we do?" gasped the woman.
"Can we offer these people hospitality? Is the dirt floor of our hovel to be theirs, and the pickings of last week's hoe cake? Shall they then go to our neighbors?"
Nairobi purpled past the crimson induced by the cold, and his arms in their sleek fur covering lunged out and seized the woman's brawny shoulders.
"Wife of my soul," he purred, "you will take the 2 chairs from our room downstairs. You will see that a fat youngling is slaughtered and roasted with tubers. You will bake a fresh hoe cake. I go now to greet these men of power from outer space. And...
He paused, placed his great cap awry, and scratched hesitantly.
"Yes, I shall bring my jug of brewed grain as well. Hearty drink is pleasant."
The woman's mouth had flapped idly during this speech. Nothing came out. And when that stage passed, it was only a discordant screech that issued. Nairobi lifted a finger.
"Old woman, what was it the village elders said a sennight since? Huh? Stir your memory. The elders went from farm to farm, themselves. Imagine the importance of it. To ask us that should any ships from outer space land, they were to be informed immediately on the orders of the governor. And now shall I not seize the opportunity to win into the good graces of those in power? Regard that ship. Have you ever seen its like? These men from outer worlds are rich, great. The governor himself sends such urgent messages concerning them that the elders walk from farm to farm in the cooling weather. Perhaps the message is sent throughout all Rossim that these men are greatly desired by the lords of Tazenda. And it is on my farm that they are landing. He fairly hopped for anxiety. The proper hospitality now, the mention of my name to the governor, and what may not be ours? His wife was suddenly aware of the cold biting through her thin house clothing. She leaped towards the door, shouting over her shoulders, "Leave then, quickly!" But she was speaking to a man who was even then racing towards the segment of the horizon against which the ship sank. Neither the cold of the world, nor its bleak, empty spaces, worry General Han Pritcher, nor the poverty of the surroundings, nor the perspiring peasant himself. What did bother him was the question of the wisdom of their tactics. He and Shanice were alone here. The ship, left in space, could take care of itself in ordinary circumstances, but still he felt unsafe. It was Shanice, of course, who was responsible for this move. He looked across at the young man and caught him winking cheerfully at the gap in the furred partition, in which a woman's peeping eyes and gaping mouth momentarily appeared. Shanice, at least, seemed completely at ease. That fact Pritcher savored with a vinegary satisfaction. His game had not much longer to proceed exactly as he wished it. Yet meanwhile, their wrist ultra-wave sender receivers were their only connection with the ship. And then the peasant host smiled enormously and bobbed his head several times, and said in a voice oily with respect, "Noble lords, I crave leave to tell you that my eldest son, a good, worthy lad, whom my poverty prevents from educating as his wisdom deserves, has informed me that the elders will arrive soon. I trust your stay here has been as pleasant as my humble means, for I am poverty-stricken, though a hard-working, honest, and humble farmer, as anyone here will tell you, could afford." "Elders," said Shanice lightly, "the chief men of the region here?" "So they are, noble lords, and honest, worthy men, all of them, for our entire village is known throughout Rossim as a just and righteous spot, though living is hard and the returns of the fields and forests meager. Perhaps you will mention to the elders, noble lords, of my respect and honor for travelers, and it may happen that they will request a new motor wagon for our household, as the old one can scarcely creep, and upon the remnant of it depends our livelihood." He looked humbly eager, and Han Pritcher nodded with the properly aloof condescension required of the role of noble lords bestowed upon them. "A report of your hospitality shall reach the ears of your elders." Pritcher seized the next moments of isolation to speak to the apparently half-sleeping Shanice. "I am not particularly fond of this meeting of the elders," he said. "Have you any thoughts on the subject?" Shanice seemed surprised. "No. What worries you?" "It seems we have better things to do than to become conspicuous here." Shanice spoke hastily, in a low, monotoned voice. "It may be necessary to risk becoming conspicuous in our next moves. We won't find the type of men we want, Pritcher, by simply reaching out a hand into a dark bag and groping. Men who rule by tricks of the mind need not necessarily be men in obvious power. In the first place, the psychologists of the Second Foundation are probably a very small minority of the total population, just as on your own First Foundation, the technicians and scientists formed a minority. The ordinary inhabitants are probably just that, very ordinary. The psychologists may even be well hidden, and the men in the apparently ruling position may honestly think they are the true masters. Our solution to that problem may be found here on this frozen lump of a planet." "I don't follow that at all. Why, see here, it's obvious enough. Tazenda is probably a huge world of millions or hundreds of millions. How could we identify the psychologists among them and be able to report truly to the mule that we have located the Second Foundation? But here, on this tiny peasant world and subject planet, all the Tazendian rulers, our host informs us, are concentrated in their chief village of gentry. There may be only a few hundred of them there, Pritcher, and among them must be one or more of the men of the Second Foundation. We will go there eventually, but let us see the elders first. It's a logical step on the way." They drew apart easily as their black-bearded host tumbled into the room again, obviously agitated. "Noble lords, the elders are arriving. I crave leave to beg you once more to mention a word, perhaps, on my behalf." He almost bent double in a paroxysm of fawning. "We shall certainly remember you," said Shanice.
Are these your elders? They apparently were. There were three. One approached. He bowed with a dignified respect and said, "We are honored. Transportation has been provided, respected sirs, and we hope for the pleasure of your company at our meeting hall." Third interlude. The first speaker gazed wistfully at the night sky. Wispy clouds scudded across the faint star gleams. Space looked actively hostile. It was cold and awful at best, but now it contained that strange creature, the mule, and the very content seemed to darken and thicken it into ominous threat. The meeting was over. It had not been long. There had been the doubts and questionings inspired by the difficult mathematical problem of dealing with a mental mutant of uncertain makeup. All the extreme permutations had to be considered. Were they even yet certain? Somewhere in this region of space, within reaching distance as galactic spaces go, was the mule. What would he do? It was easy enough to handle his men. They reacted, and were reacting, according to plan. But what of the mule himself? Chapter 4. Two Men and the Elders. The elders of this particular region of Rossim were not exactly what one might have expected. They were not a mere extrapolation of the peasantry. Older, more authoritative, less friendly. Not at all. The dignity that had marked them at first meeting had grown in impression till it had reached the mark of being their predominant characteristic. They sat about their oval table like so many grave and slow-moving thinkers. Most were a trifle past their physical prime, though the few who possessed beards wore them short and neatly arranged. Still, enough appeared younger than 40 to make it quite obvious that elders was a term of respect rather than entirely a literal description of age. The two from outer space were at the head of the table, and in the solemn silence that accompanied a rather frugal meal that seemed ceremonious rather than nourishing, absorbed the new, contrasting atmosphere. After the meal, and one or two respectful remarks, too short and simple to be called speeches, had been made by those of the elders apparently held most in esteem, an informality forced itself upon the assembly. It was as if the dignity of greeting foreign personages had finally given way to the amiable, rustic qualities of curiosity and friendliness. They crowded around the two strangers, and a flood of questions came. They asked if it were difficult to handle a spaceship, how many men were required for the job, if better motors could be made for their ground cars, if it was true that it rarely snowed on other worlds, as was said to be the case with Tezenda, how many people lived on their world, if it was as large as Tezenda, if it was far away, how their clothes were woven, and what gave them the metallic shimmer, why they did not wear furs, if they shaved every day, what sort of stone was that in Pritchard's ring, the list stretched out. And almost always the questions were addressed to Pritchard, as though as the elder, they automatically invested him with the greater authority. Pritchard found himself forced to answer at greater and greater length. It was like an immersion in a crowd of children. Their questions were those of utter and disarming wonder. Their eagerness to know was completely irresistible and would not be denied. Pritchard explained that spaceships were not difficult to handle and that crews varied with the size, from one to many, that the motors of their ground cars were unknown in detail to him, but could doubtless be improved, that the climates of worlds varied almost infinitely, that many hundreds of millions lived on his world, but that it was far smaller and more insignificant than the great empire of Tezenda, that their clothes were woven of silicone plastics, in which metallic luster was artificially produced by proper orientation of the surface molecules, and that they could be artificially heated so that furs were unnecessary, that they shaved every day, that the stone in his ring was an amethyst. The list stretched out. He found himself thawing to these naive provincials against his will. And always, as he answered, there was a rapid chatter among the elders, as though they debated the information gained. It was difficult to follow these inner discussions of theirs, for they lapsed into their own accented version of the universal galactic language, that through long separation from the currents of living speech had become archaic. Almost, one might say, their curt comments among themselves hovered on the edge of understanding, but just managed to elude the clutching tendrils of comprehension. Until finally Chanis interrupted to say, "Good sirs, you must answer us for a while, for we are strangers and would be very much interested to know all we can of Tezenda." And what happened then was that a great silence fell, and each of the hitherto voluble elders grew silent. Their hands, which had been moving in such rapid and delicate accompaniment to their words, as though to give them greater scope and varied shades of meaning, fell suddenly limp. They stared furtively at one another, apparently quite willing each to let the other have all the floor. Pritchard interposed quickly. "My companion asks this in friendliness, for the fame of Tazenda fills the galaxy, and we, of course, shall inform the governor of the loyalty and love of the elders of Rossem." No sigh of relief was heard, but faces brightened. An elder stroked his beard with thumb and forefinger, straightened its slight curl with a gentle pressure, and said, "We are faithful servants of the lords of Tazenda." Pritchard's annoyance at Chanice's bald question subsided. It was apparent, at least, that the age that he had felt creeping over him of late had not yet deprived him of his own capacity for making smooth the blunders of others. He continued, "But we do not know, in our far part of the universe, much of the past history of the lords of Tazenda. We presume they have ruled benevolently here for a long time." The same elder who spoke before answered. In a soft, automatic way, he had become spokesman. He said, "Not the grandfather of the oldest can recall a time in which the lords were absent. It has been a time of peace. It has been a time of peace." He hesitated. "The governor is a strong and powerful lord who would not hesitate to punish traitors. None of us are traitors, of course. He has punished some in the past, I imagine, as they deserve." Again, hesitation. "None here have ever been traitors, or our fathers, or our fathers' fathers. But on other worlds there have been such, and death followed for them quickly. It is not good to think of, for we are humble men who are poor farmers and not concerned with matters of politics." The anxiety in his voice, the universal concern in the eyes of all of them, was obvious. Pritchard said smoothly, "Could you inform us as to how we can arrange an audience with your governor?" And instantly an element of sudden bewilderment entered the situation. For after a long moment, the elder said, "Why, did you not know? The governor will be here tomorrow. He has expected you. It has been a great honor for us. We hope earnestly that you will report to him satisfactorily as to our loyalty to him." Pritchard's smile scarcely twitched. "Expected us?" The elder looked wonderingly from one to the other. "Why, it is now a week since we have been waiting for you." Their quarters were undoubtedly luxurious for the world. Pritchard had lived in worse. Janice showed nothing but indifference to externals. But there was an element of tension between them of a different nature than hitherto. Pritchard felt the time approaching for a definite decision, and yet there was still the desirability of additional waiting. To see the governor first would be to increase the gamble to dangerous dimensions, and yet to win that gamble might multi-double the winnings. He felt a surge of anger at the slight crease between Chanice's eyebrows, the delicate uncertainty with which the young man's lower lip presented itself to an upper tooth. He detested the useless play-acting, and yearned for an end to it. He said, "We seem to be anticipated." "Yes," said Chanice simply. "Just that? You have no contribution of greater pith to make? We come here and find that the governor expects us. Presumably we shall find from the governor that Tazenda itself expects us. Of what value, then, is our entire mission?" Chanice looked up, without endeavoring to conceal the weary note in his voice. "To expect us is one thing. To know who we are and what we came for is another. Do you expect to conceal these things from men of the Second Foundation?" "Perhaps. Why not? Are you ready to throw your hand in? Suppose our ship was detected in space. Is it unusual for a realm to maintain frontier observation posts? Even if we were ordinary strangers, we would be of interest. Sufficient reason for a governor to come to us rather than the reverse?" Janice shrugged. "We'll have to meet that problem later. Let us see what the governor is like." Pritchard bared his teeth in a bloodless kind of scowl. The situation was becoming ridiculous. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.